Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success.
Welcome back to The Entrepreneur Architect, the podcast where architects learn to build better businesses. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is episode 11. In this episode, I speak with Kevin DeFreitas. Kevin is an architect based in San Diego, California, and he is a great storyteller. It was a pleasure spending some time with him, talking about his firm and how he's succeeding as an entrepreneur architect. Kevin's a sole proprietor, but he's competing with much larger firms. And what interested me most about Kevin is how his firm is structured. I learned a bunch from him, and I hope you do too. So here we go. Here's the interview. Hope you enjoy it. So today we're recording from Five Cat Studio, and so you might hear a little bit of a different audio today. But today we're speaking with Kevin DeFreitas from San Diego. How you doing, Kevin?
Good, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing well. You and I connected a little bit through Residential Architect magazine.
Yes.
We were both featured in the last, I guess it was the July-August issue of Residential Architect magazine, an article written by Cheryl Weber called The Rebound, and you and I were both interviewed by Cheryl for that article. And in that article, you talked a little bit about how your firm was structured, which we'll get into a little bit later. But that's what interested me and wanted me, why I wanted you to come onto the podcast and talk a little bit about your firm and how it's structured. But before we get into that, what I'd like to do is get into who you are and where you've come from, what inspired you to become an architect, and kind of tell us the background and the story of how you ended up where you are today.
All right. Who am I? That's a great existential question to start with. I'm going to start with a softball. So I grew up in San Diego and born and raised in one home that my parents actually, who were both school teachers, had commissioned by an architect. And it was a really seminal experience for me. I never moved from that house until I went off to college. And I felt like I had a pretty lengthy conversation with the architect that designed it just through living in this space. It was very different than all of my friends' homes. And for me, I didn't know any differently, but they would always comment when they would come over, and kind of stuck in the back of my head. But I'm terrible at drawing. I'm terrible at math. And so it wasn't something that I was necessarily attracted to. I started college here at a small Catholic school named University of San Diego, and just studying general ed, and had the opportunity to work for a contractor as a laborer, a personal friend. And so I thought, oh gosh, this is great. We were designing a custom home, or we were building a home that was custom designed. beautiful, beautiful house overlooking a pretty picturesque valley. And we were outside without our shirts on and having fun and building this house. And I thought, oh, I'll be a contractor. And the guy that I was working for was a few years older than me at the time. And he had some back issues. And I said, oh, what's the matter with your back? And he was really fit. And he said, well, I fell off the second story a couple times. And these discs, 18 through 23 are all compressed or cracked or whatever. I'm like, oh, gosh, you don't see too many old contractors. And one day the architect visited the site, and he had this vintage Mercedes convertible, and he had one of those go fast hats on backwards and a silk scarf. And the approach to the house was about a half a mile long. And I remember watching him drive up to the house, and he gets out, and big, tall guy, 6'5", probably one of the most prominent architects in San Diego right now, a guy named Rob Quigley. And he gets out and starts pointing and gesticulating in his deep voice. And he just had a command of the whole site. And I'm like, that's a job for me. And that's kind of how it started. So I applied to schools, and University of Arizona was the first one that did not require calculus and did not require language to graduate. And I applied to one school and got in and went, and the rest is history.
So tell us a little bit about your firm today. What type of work do you do, and how do you structure your firm?
That's an interesting question, because about 4 years ago, before things kind of melted down, I did almost 100% residential. And right now I'm doing the first home that I've done in 4 years, and it's actually for my sister. So kind of transitioned to institutional and different types of projects. But these days it's really more about the quality of the project than the type of project that I pursue. And fortunately, I've had the opportunity to work on some really fantastic projects with very engaged, collaborative clients. And so I don't turn down a project because of its size or its budget or anything else. It completely has to do with the quality of the client and what they want to accomplish, and if I'm the right fit to help them do that.
That's quite a luxury. How do you get to the position in your career that you can do that?
Well, I think it's a model how the office operates, and we've been able to really strip down the overhead to virtually nothing. It's an internet connection, a cell phone, and pretty modest equipment. And by not having to feed the beast every month, it's really helped me not take projects that are purely financially motivated, but more seek out clients and projects that were the best fit for the office. And in turn, I think we've been able to do the best work that we're able to accomplish. And it's been recognized and published, and as a result, bred more of those types of projects. So it's been a win-win kind of situation.
When did you launch the firm?
1998 is when I was last employed by another firm.
Okay, and so the firm, how many people work with you?
That's an interesting question. I'm essentially a sole proprietor, but I work with a collection of other similar practitioners that are sole proprietors, having 10, 15, 20 years of experience at other firms and have since gone out on their own. And we have this loose collaboration where we work digitally and are able to execute projects that way. It's a very flexible model because they're not employees, they're contractors. In fact, none of them are even in San Diego where I'm located. Two of them are in Pasadena, husband and wife team, my prime collaborators, Manish and Emily Desai. And then a couple of others that are also in the LA area. And what works great about this model is it's infinitely flexible, and we can gang up on projects when there's a deadline. Each one of these individuals is essentially a principal level, And so they know how to do their craft exceptionally well. And they each have kind of a specialty that they like. One of them is very interested in code issues and code analysis and things like that. Other individuals super interested in the 3D graphics, and others have more retail and commercial experience, others restaurants. So we can put the resources that are necessary on the given task at hand and get it done. And the beauty for me is it takes a lot of pressure off. They know how to do the parts that I'm asking them to do better than I do. So I can explain it in very simple terms, know that it's going to come back right and better than if I were to do it. And so that gives me a lot of confidence to keep moving and not have to spend a lot of time back-checking all the work. It's coordinated and just done at a very high level of quality.
So it sounds very much, the relationship you have with them is very much like you would as if they were in your own firm, where you would see them every day, where you start, you know, building this relationship where you start thinking the same way and you understand the way you want things done. You don't really need to do a lot of conversation about it. Is that how it works?
It very much so. And so I had more staff before, and what it did was push me more into a managerial role, but mm-hmm. those are my least developed skills, and I'm frankly not very good at it. I would spend a lot of time explaining something, and they would get bored and kind of tune out, and they would come back and not what I was hoping for. And sometimes I had difficulty communicating, this is a 2-hour task, don't spend 8 hours on it, or this is an 8-hour task, don't spend 2 hours on it. And so it started to remove me from the tasks that I actually liked in the job, which were the drawings and dealing with the clients and dealing more with management issues, which I was not as well equipped to handle. So this way, a client walks into a firm that has, say, 30 or 40 people, a big firm, and it's very impressive edifice and conference table, et cetera. And in the back of their mind, even though they don't know it to be true, they really believe that all 30 people on that staff are going to jump on their project and give them, 100% service.
Right.
It's really not the reality. There's the rainmaker who sells the job, and then there's the job captain, who project manager, who runs it, and then there's interns and various staff of different quality that are working on the project. And usually it's 4 or 5 people, even on a fairly decent sized project. This model is unusual in that it allows me to put basically 3, 4, 5 principal level individuals on that project. And so I think the service and the quality of the work produced is exemplary and something that sometimes catches them off guard and they deeply appreciate. And so it started to create quite a bit of loyalty as well.
Do your clients know that you're structured this way?
No. So it's we go out of our way to hide it.
you go out of your way, or you don't go out of your way?
I do go out of my way to hide it.
Yeah.
And simply because of this prejudice of a small firm. I just did an award-winning project for the city of San Diego. It was a public restroom on the beach here in San Diego. And it's a small building, but it was rare for the city of San Diego because it won design awards, it won sustainability awards. And usually those are two very distinctly different things. And then it won Public Works Awards, which the city of San Diego really never enjoys. And so my project manager, I said, well, I'd really, really love to do a fire station. And she's like, oh, have you done a fire station before? And I said, no. And she said, well, they're complex buildings. And I don't know, if you don't have that in your portfolio, I don't know if you can do it. And I'm thinking to myself, a fire station is essentially a large house. It has a huge garage, eating facilities, sleeping facilities, a workout room, storage and equipment. And not to downplay it and say that it's not a complex structure and systems, but I've done custom homes that are much larger in square footage and budget and technical complexity. But again, there's this prejudice, if you haven't done it before, that you can't do one in the future. And so there's a distinct prejudice about that, I think. And because of the resources that I'm able to garner with these other individuals that are they're working with me and collaborating with me, we can cover so much back in terms of just having a depth of experience that you don't have in a traditional setup where you have the striations of different employees with different skill levels and years of experience. So yes, I very much try and downplay that because it doesn't go to our advantage. I imagine that there are more firms doing what we're doing, and in the future it won't be an issue.
Yeah.
But right now it still feels like there is.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask next. Is do you see this as sort of the future of the small firm, and do you imagine that at some point it will become, you know, so commonplace that people expect that's the way small firms are running?
That's a good question. I don't know if it works for everybody, and I don't like to speak in absolutes. This works for us, and we've been doing it for a long time, so we're very, very comfortable, and the technology allows us to service the clients in ways that they didn't expect. We just finished a project at University of California, San Diego, and they were just incredibly impressed at our ability to respond to RFIs and ASIs, turn things around incredibly quickly, and service them. And again, by taking on fewer projects, but projects we care deeply about, we're mentally more engaged. We're kind of always solving problems, whether they've been identified or not, because we're always thinking about the projects rather than trying to work on as many projects, a quantitative approach, we're working on a qualitative. Mm-hmm. So by keeping the overhead low and the operation very lean, we're able to invest a lot more hours in a traditional firm into a project. And again, that benefits us because the client feels very serviced. The end result is the absolute best that we're able to produce. And then if we end up with a beautiful project that's photographable and then, you know, we're able to use those images to market on websites like Arc Daily or in our local AIA chapter awards programs and get published, then it benefits us as well. So to answer your question, I don't know. My sense is that this, for a certain group of small practitioners, this is a great model. Whether it works for everyone, I don't know. It really depends on finding that special group of collaborators that have the experience that you need, that you can work with and trust and kind of grow with. So I don't know if that's a real answer or not,
yeah.
But
yeah.
It seems to me there's a huge opportunity, and it's, these doors have been opened wide by the availability of amazing technology, like the technology we're using right now, having this really crystal clear conversation that doesn't cost us a penny, the entire width of this country.
Yeah, exactly.
I could be on a boat right now and you wouldn't know it.
Right.
I could be in my office in a suit or in shorts and a t-shirt, and it really doesn't matter. You're getting the information that you need, and I'm communicating the information that I need to share with you, and the relationship works. And if we can do it at a high quality level and an affordable price, and the quality of the product is excellent, you could care less whether I was in Hawaii or Kansas.
Yeah, I think there's a location independence that's happening where it doesn't really matter where you're located as long as you can get the work done, and you can get, you know, you can market yourself to get new work, then you can do it from anywhere you want. So how is your firm, you know, how is it, you know, technically, how is it structured? You know, what are your agreements like with your collaborators, and how do they get paid?
So we determine the value of the project, and sometimes if it's a high design project, it's one that we want to work on, but the budget's not super deep. They will actually give me a lower hourly rate, and that's how we work on an hourly rate.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a predetermined amount, and they have a sliding scale kind of based on what the project budget is, and I share that with them, very candid, and kind of what the expectations of this project are. And so they will fluctuate based on on those specific criteria. And if they're very busy, then they just say, hey, I can't help out for the next month, but we have this pool that we can draw from. So there's always enough individuals to get done what we need to do, and we can gang up on it. And they have peers as well within their networks. So again, a couple times we've gotten into some tight timeframes, and we just were able to marshal the resources that we need and get it done. But it's strictly on an hourly basis, and they invoice on a biweekly or monthly, whatever works for them, and then they're just paid that way.
So what do you think, is the greatest benefit for working digitally? What's the best thing from both your point of view as the firm owner, as well as, from a client's point of view?
I think I've already stated it. I think it really comes down to not having to take projects that we don't care about. And that's an incredible luxury these days. I mean, things are still quite difficult in design and construction here in San Diego. We haven't experienced the recovery that the Bay Area has, or even parts of LA. So by being able to take projects that we really care about, we're able to engage in the most meaningful way and do our best work. And as a result, I think there's less kind of noise, I guess, in the office, and that we're not spreading ourselves across multiple projects, caring about some more than others. So the bread and butter projects we don't necessarily have to take unless we choose to. So I think that's the biggest thing, is that this digital practice model that we've developed allows us just to be super, super lean. And that allows us then to select projects very, very carefully, either projects that we believe are portfolio builders or just excellent design opportunities. And then pursuing projects that we really care about, we're able to do the best work. And I think then the client undoubtedly gets the best attention and the best product.
What about on a personal level? Is there some benefits or drawbacks, from a firm / family point of view, like a work life integration point of view?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. I'm one of those practitioners that falls in the I absolutely love what I do category. And so when I have some free time, I'm more likely to flip through an architecture magazine or read a blog than I am to watch a football game. So I think that the huge benefit for me is lifestyle. It allows me not to have to be tied to the office managing staff. And so I'm able to do all the morning drop-offs for our four children. I've coached all of their little league softball and soccer teams, and that usually starts early afternoon. I'm able to attend all of their school plays and recitals and award ceremonies and drive on field trips and things like that. So there is quite a bit of flexibility in the schedule to do those things, because there's not other people depending on me on an hour by hour basis for direction and guidance and oversight and things like that. Now, the con is also tied to that as well, in that as a sole practitioner, and this model has allowed me to do much bigger projects. 5, 6, 7 years ago, it was really difficult to do projects larger than residential, just because I couldn't do all the things that I needed to: write specs, write contracts, do PR, do the drawings, do the CA and things. But with this model, it's really outsourcing it to an insourced group of collaborators, and so it's a blended model. But the biggest downside for me is this profession is my work, it's my hobby, it's my passion, it's all those things kind of rolled into one. Yeah, and so when big deadlines come up, I've got to orchestrate everything and make sure that they get done. And so the days sometimes can be 16, 17 hours long to get it all done. And so I still do the family things, but then it's take a power nap and then get up and work from midnight to 3 o'clock in the morning, which are incredibly productive hours for me, because there's no cell phone, there's no email. It's just focus, and my brain seems to really like that time. So the downside is I think my wife would probably say that this profession is all consuming and somewhat like a third partner in the marriage.
Yeah. Especially when it's in your house.
Yes. And as a small practitioner, it's very, very difficult to modulate the workflow. So if you have one project that's decent size, you're doing okay. If you have two, you're pretty busy. If you have three, you're just absolutely swamped, depending on the size of the projects. And then if you have zero, you're starving, you know, and you're scared. And so so I think that's it's probably a closer to a hand-to-mouth existence. And sometimes my wife will say, well, why don't you go work for a firm and, you know, you can enjoy that stability. But these days, my peers have been, you know, laid off. They'll get hired for a project, and as soon as that 8-12 month cycle is done, then they're cut loose. And so I don't think there's any more stability in traditional firms. And certainly have a little bit more ability to control the financial situation. So it's certainly more profitable for me to work on my own. But the second part of your question is what's the impact on it, on the family. My wife does work. She teaches at a local college, Point Loma Nazarene University, and in part because we get our medical benefits through there. And that's here in San Diego, that's about a $1,200 a month expense that she picks up as part of her benefit package. So I think she feels a little bit of pressure to maintain a more consistent traditional job that allows me to pursue this path.
Yeah. You know, my wife and I are partners. She's an architect as well. And, you know, we talk about that all the time. We have our own firm. And, you know, through the past 5 years, it's been disastrous as far as, you know, the finances. You know, I've written about it on the blog. It's you know, I've been pretty transparent about, you know, how things have been. And it's been really difficult. And, you know, throughout that time, there were many times where we said, you know, maybe we should just wrap this up and go work for somebody else. And then we look at where we are and look at, you know, the not only the business and the success we've had with the business, but the success we've had with our kids and our family and our personal relationship. That would be completely different if, you know, I had to go to work, you know, an hour away and, you know, and work for 10 hours a day and then come home and my kids are just about hitting the pillow. The sacrifices that I've, you know, that we've made financially have certainly been outweighed by the benefits of being more involved with my family.
That's so true. And we just sent our oldest to college this year. We enrolled, took John Paul up to Montana State. And, you know, my thought dropping him off was I knew this day was coming for 18 years. But then it felt like it snuck up on me. And there's a few bucket list things that I'd hoped to do with him, you know, like skin a bear and teach him how to change oil and, you know, all those things. Yeah. And so this last year, we actually got to do quite a few of those things. We went to a 3-day music festival here in Southern California called Coachella. And he is on the tennis team and enjoys tennis. So we went out to a professional tournament that they have here called Indian Wells. And so we got to do some of those things. And but you're right, you know, you just get into the routine, and then before you know it, 3 years have elapsed, 10 years have elapsed, and you're taking your kids to college and you're like, where did it go? So the lifestyle issues, while there is a pro and a con to it, is a huge, huge reason and motivator for doing this the way that I have, because it just does give me flexibility. I don't commute at all. I can take time off to do the things that I need to do. I usually have to make up those hours later on. So, you know, there is flexibility, but within some constraints. But I really feel fortunate that I've been as involved in my children's lives as this situation has allowed me to.
Yeah. So how do you think, you know, other architects could start doing what you do? Because you've been doing it for a long time. What are a few tips and maybe also tools, you know, maybe from a technological point of view, what are some of the tools that you use where somebody who's thinking about doing this, they could, you know, maybe write a plan and think about how they're going to accomplish it and start integrating some of the tools that you use?
Yeah, that's a good question. And you do such a great job on your blog talking and explaining to practitioners that might be thinking about making the leap out on their own and starting to start small as possible in terms of fixed expenses, not renting a space if possible, working out of your house or a garage or some space that you already control and pay rent or mortgage on. Yeah. And then growing as your income allows you to do so, rather than starting with what your vision is and then trying to find the income to support that. And I think that's so smart. It's so responsible. The model that we're using is actually probably a one level, you know, above that, which is really not having any of those traditional architectural office trappings and using what you already have. So we have a couple computers, a couple printers. We don't even have a plotter. It's so much easier to send it out to our neighborhood repro. And again, that's digital. Back in the day, you know, you put out the vellums and the driver would come by and pick them up, and then you'd pray that they could get it done in the 3 hours that you needed before the meeting when the client was coming in, and then they bring it back and so forth. Now it's just you zip the files, send them over to the FTP, easy peasy. They deliver them. They can print them, you know, any size, color that you need, and it's all done. And then the invoice comes, and so it's easy to track the reimbursables, transferring their invoices straight into that. And so there's. We don't really have any special tools per se, just our computers. You know, we have full versions of AutoCAD. I use an iPhone, which is kind of a computer in my pocket. It does all my scheduling. It pushes all my emails forward. Our internet provider here in San Diego is Cox Communication. And so when you called earlier and left a message, it translates it into a little audio file and emails it to my phone. So even when I'm not there, I'm able to get messages instantaneously. And that's something I just signed up for in the last couple of weeks. So the communication's really remarkable now with some of the programs. And we use Skype, which is an excellent tool. We have our website provider has a pretty deep FTP site that we use to transfer files to clients and exchange images with the collaboration team with updated folders.
So when you collaborate with your collaborators, you're doing that all through FTP?
Correct.
So no Dropbox or anything on the cloud or any of that?
Correct. So all the files live on the FTP, and then we grab those and add and subtract. And then we spend a lot of time just on the phone, a couple hours a day, as we're going through ideas. So my main collaborator, Manish, he's incredible with the 3D, and he uses a program called FormZ. Mm-hmm. So we're sending screen views, snapshots back and forth, and we're basically designing together, looking at the screen as we send things back and forth, and we'll comment. And we use a lot of inspirational images to kind of communicate where we'd like to go or ideas. So I spend a lot of time on the internet browsing, yeah, and looking for resource images. But surprisingly, we don't have anything that I bet everybody that's listening to this podcast has right in front of them, technology-wise.
Right. Well, it sounds like it's a great way to run a small practice and have the flexibility to grow as you need.
It really is, and the you know I don't have the ability to fire people. And so that was the most painful part when the fit wasn't right, you know, how to let people go. And I was not a very strong student. And I think what's allowed me to make it this far in the profession is just persistence. And so I see that in young practitioners coming up. And I think that is a fundamental downside to this model, because it works because I found collaborators, like I said before, that are principal level individuals, that they've cut their teeth and been trained by other firms. Yeah. And our profession is so much based on this idea of mentorship. And so the one real ugly side I see of this model is that it's very difficult for interns now to get their foot in their door, to get the experience that they need. You can't just download this information purely in a factual way. Practitioners have to practice, and that just takes time. And that experience is so vital. It was for me, and learning from the firms that hired me and were willing to invest in me. And so this model doesn't really work for that. And so we're producing more architecture grads every year. There's more and more programs, and it's a highly desired major, I think, for a lot of students. But the recession has fundamentally changed the profession, and I don't know really where the future is. It's interesting, when I graduated in 1992, faxes were kind of really hitting the scene. And I thought, man, that's like pure magic. It's like fire had come out of the sky, that you can sketch something, you know, put it through the phone line and send it to the contractor out in the field. And in minutes, you can have a conversation and looking at the same thing. It's so difficult to describe graphical things just verbally. And so now there's this picture. And now, you know, who uses a fax 20 years later? Nobody. And the guys that graduated 5 years old, you know, before I did, pretty much are still hand drafting, because they got pushed up into middle management by the time AutoCAD really hit, and they weren't doing full-time production. And I'm pretty much an AutoCAD guy, and I feel like I've become a dinosaur as everything's moved on to Revit and more of these 3D modeling programs that I just haven't had the time to invest to learn. And so, you know, architects from Leonardo da Vinci till my peers drew with a T-square and a triangle, you know, for 500 years. And then it moved to AutoCAD, and then within a 2D AutoCAD, and within, you know, 20 years, it's gone on to this 3D and Revit and things, and is moving forward. So there's been some incredible tumultuous shifts in just the way that we've practiced, and the tools and the methods that we use. And so it's exciting. It's opened up huge opportunities, but I think there'll be some consequences that maybe we haven't thought about. And I think one of them is this break in the continuity of how we train young practitioners.
Yeah, well, you know, I think with the technology and with sort of the disruption in the profession, because there's a lot of, discomfort and miscommunication and lack of definition in the profession.
Yes.
And I think with that, those sentiments and the technologies that we have and this economy that we're coming out, I think we're going to see new business models. And I think this business model that you have is one of them. And I think that there'll be others that we don't know about yet. The technologies that we have, the business models will have to catch up to what those models or what that technology is allowing us to do. And I think, you know, one of the things that will have to be addressed is how do we, you know, bring up the next generation of architects without, you know, physical buildings and physical spaces in which we work. I'm sure that will always exist, you know, and they're not going to go away, but maybe there'll be technology that will allow that to happen as well, where you have, you know, full-time live streaming of, you know, on huge monitors where, you know, you can have somebody collaborating with you and literally sitting right next to you, but they're 1,000 miles away.
And it's true. Yep.
What technology will bring next? You know, just in that scenario that you just stated, where you went from, you know, fax machines to, you know, to email and you know, full on Skype calls and things like that. You know, in such a small amount of time, you know, what's going to happen in the next 5 or 10 years is going to be really exciting to see where architecture goes.
I couldn't agree with you more, and it excites me more than it scares me. But just my use of AutoCAD, I probably have a mastery of maybe 10% of what that program can do. Yeah. And so it just reminds me of that whole notion where, you know, neuroscientists say that we only use a very small portion of our brains. It just seems like there's so much capacity out there and opportunity. So I think it's incredibly exciting. And the collaborations that can happen, you know, I have a couple projects that have made it up on ArcDaily, and then I start getting inquiries for jobs from practitioners that are in Europe and Australia, New Zealand, and that's possible. Where, you know, so the exciting thing about that is you can find the highest quality collaborator, and they don't have to be in your local market. Yeah. So that is amazing, and you're right. I think it's the ones that will be successful will be the practitioners that can harness this technology and use it in a way that's beneficial, not only for themselves, but ultimately the client. And you asked this question earlier, and I was thinking a little bit more about it as we've been talking. My primary collaborator, Manish, his wife, Emily, also an architect, a trained architect, is incredibly good at graphics. And so she does a lot of our presentations for us. She's very good with materials and finishes and things like that. And so in our last project that we did for UC San Diego, we were actually able to add a lot more value add to the service because we were able to do all of the interiors in-house, and we were able to do all the environmental wayfinding and accessibility graphics in-house instead of having to bring in additional consultants to do that. The benefit was it was incredibly less expensive for the client. We wanted to do those things so that it was harmonious and, you know, the design approach was holistic. They were all tied together. And so we were able to produce that at a fraction of what independent consultants would do. And in the end, we felt it was a superior product because, again, it was designed by the same team that had done the architecture as well. So I think that even the traditional architecture practice is morphing. Firms aren't just doing pure construction documents and construction administration and things like that, but they're branching out into web design, graphic packages. If you're, you know, I have a couple peers that are doing restaurant designs, and they will get very involved in even just designing the menus and the uniforms. Yeah. And so as the practice of design is expanding, I think architecture firms have the opportunity to provide quite a bit of value add to their clients in terms of the services that they can offer them. And every time you add more consultants, there's more coordination, there's more opportunities to things to go rogue or terribly wrong. And there's a certain buy-in cost to add another consultant to the team. So there's efficiencies of being able to do some of those tasks in-house. So that's not to say that other consultants aren't better at what they do, but sometimes clients can't afford to have an environmental graphics package done by a consultant, but they are willing to pay a little bit more to the design team to do it because it does work for them. So at a price point that is more economical. So I think that is another benefit as well of this evolving architectural practice is the technology is allowing it, and the cost of programs. You know, just on my machine, I have all the Adobe products. I have InDesign and Illustrator and full AutoCAD and Revit and things. And when I was first getting into it, those programs were prohibitively expensive. Really, you needed to be a firm to purchase those. But the programming and software has become so sophisticated and really quite affordable. And what you can do with it is extraordinary. And so I couldn't agree with you more that things are evolving. The practice is changing very quickly. The technology is in front of us, and we have to figure out how to harness it and use it for our own benefit in terms of speed and quality and profitability, but also to enhance the experience and the product and the quality for the client.
Yeah. Yeah. And just to go back a little bit about what you said about, you know, providing additional value to your clients, that from a business point of view, which is what my focus is, that allows you to make more money. It allows you to create new revenue streams that you know, traditional architects don't provide. And that's what I think, that's what we need to do. I think it's very difficult to be financially successful only practicing architecture. There needs to be some other source of revenue coming into that firm, or as a sole practitioner, even a separate business, you know, coming into the firm to be able to bring those two things together in order to really, you know, succeed in a financial way.
Yeah, it's diversifying. Yeah. And I think all businesses that have survived this incredible, you know, economic situation are the ones that have been able to adapt and to increase productivity and to maintain quality and to keep their clients happy. Ultimately, we're service providers, and without clients, we're unemployed. And so the firms that are able to nurture clients and really give them more than what they expect, that's our 100% business model, is we contract for a certain value. And because we are leaner in terms of overhead, we are able to invest more hours in the project. And we believe that in the end, the client gets more than what they paid for. And sometimes they don't even notice it or appreciate it, but oftentimes they do, especially institutional clients that are continually doing projects. They're more sophisticated and having worked with other firms, and so they can compare one to the other. And consistently, we get incredibly complimentary responses from our clients saying that you've taken care of us in a way that we've never been taken care of before. And so I think, you know, that's part of our business model, is if you can really perform at a level that's beyond expectation, they have to be able to pass you on when other people are asking them for referrals. And also, you have to be able to move to the top of the list when they're considering their next project.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great place to end our conversation. Thank you very much for your time
today. Oh, it's all my pleasure, and I appreciate the resource that you are to entrepreneurial architects that are trying to figure these things out. It's really fantastic. You provide a remarkable service, and so I appreciate what you do.
Thank you. What's the best way for people who are listening to be able to reach out and either say thank you or ask you some questions?
Yeah, they can send me an email. The best thing to do is go to my website, and it's got a terribly stupid address because there's so many letters in it, but it is www.defratisarchitects.com, which is DEFREITAS, and then the word architects, plural.com. So www.defratisarchitects.com, or they can send me an email directly to info@defratisarchitects.com, and I'll get it and happy to respond.
Great. I'll put all that on the show notes, so anybody who's looking for that or driving, they could just go to entrearchitect.com and go to the podcast section and find the Kevin DeFratis podcast, and you'll be able to see all that on the show notes. So, Kevin, thank you very much for your time. It's been incredibly interesting and informative, and I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Mark. Thank you.
All right. Have a great day.
You too. Take care. Bye.
So now you know why I wanted to speak with Kevin. If you follow me on Twitter @EntreeArchitect, or if you're a subscriber to my newsletter, you already know that Anne-Marie and I are moving our studio out of the space that we've been at for more than 10 years, and we're building a new studio in our house so we can be, you know, more flexible with our family and our firm, and we can integrate our life a little bit more. And we're going to restructure the firm to be very much like what Kevin's describing his firm to be. So we're super excited about what's happening at Five Cat Studio. And I share all of that on my newsletter every week. I give you updates and sort of behind the scenes on what's going on at Five Cat Studio and Entrepreneur Architect. I write it in a much more casual way than the blog, and it's a lot of fun to write. So I do hope that you sign up for that. It's entrearchitect.com/newsletter. It's free. And I include a link every week to that week's blog post article and every month's podcast episode. So you won't miss anything if you're a subscriber to the newsletter. Sign up at entrearchitect.com/newsletter. And I'd love to know what you think about this episode. So head on over to the blog right now, unless you're driving, of course, do it later, and leave me a comment. About either about Kevin's conversation with me or about the things that are going on at Five Cat Studio. I'd love to know what you want, and I truly, truly appreciate your participation in this ride that I'm taking here with Entrepreneur Architect. I love the comments. I love the email, so please keep them coming on Twitter, on Facebook. I'm all over the place. You can find me anywhere you go. Just search for Entree Architect, and you'll find me. So that's it. So I appreciate it. That's it for this episode. Until next time, my name is Mark R. LePage, and I am an entrepreneur architect. Thank you so much for listening.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.